This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're going to start our show by talking about history, specifically some structures that have been given the designation of a National Register of Historical Places. And we're joined by Zachary J. Lechner. He is a historic preservation specialist with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Zach, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Let's get a little background before we talk about the structures that caught our eye in Grand Forks. What is the National Register of Historical Places?
The National Register of Historic Places is a program. It's a federal program. It's administered by the National Park Service, and it was mandated through a piece of legislation called the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966. And so the idea is to obviously to preserve historic buildings, other types of structures, or sometimes just sites. So listings in the National Register don't necessarily, you know, have to be buildings. We sometimes think of those first because they're most visible, but they could be archaeological sites. And in fact, there are several of those just in the state of North Dakota. And so the idea is to, you know, provide, you know, recognition for historically or archaeologically significant, as I said, sites, buildings, or structures. And so in the state of North Dakota, we have over 400 such places listed in the register. And as you can imagine, throughout the United States, there's, you know, thousands of them.
What is required to get on the register?
There's four main criteria. At least one of which has to be met for the building or the site to be placed in the register. And the first of them is historical significance. It has to be a historically significant site or building, or it has to be somehow associated with some broader, you know, historical event. It can also be associated with a particularly important historical figure, you know, so like a childhood birthplace, or a home of a president, or something along those lines. It can also be designated to be placed in the register if it is the work of a master architect, or it's a particularly good example of a type of architectural style, you know, a modern style, or the brutalist style, or something along those lines. And then finally, to be placed in the register, the site or the building or the structure, it can sometimes be associated with archaeological artifacts. So it might just be a particularly important resource or repository of archaeological artifacts. So an example of that, like in North Dakota, for example, would be Fort Clark, which is a state historic site. It's an old, one of the most important fur trading posts in the early to mid 19th century. And if you go there, you'll see historic markers, you'll see earth lodge impressions, but you won't actually see any buildings, because those are structures. Those were long ago, torn down or allowed to deteriorate. But there's a lot of archaeological work that has been done and will probably continue to be done at that site. And so part of the reason, aside from important historical connections, that Fort Clark is in the register is because of the archaeological potential, or the potential that its archaeological artifacts has for helping us to learn about the fur trading and the Native American past in that area.
Earlier this month, your office sent out a news release that indicated that six schools in Grand Forks had been designated for the National Register: Ben Franklin Elementary School, Lewis and Clark Elementary, Valley Junior High, Viking Elementary, West Elementary, and Wilder Elementary School. What made these buildings significant?
So that would be, those are great examples of the third designation that I mentioned as to why something could be placed in the register. And that is because not so much that they were associated with a particularly famous architect, but because they were indicative and very good examples of a particular architectural style. And also in part because of their historical connection to post-World War II America. So these were schools that were constructed in the mid-20th century in Grand Forks, as you noted. And so they embody a period of American history that is, as many of your listeners know, was marked by the baby boom. So we had a large increase in population after World War II, a relative and fairly expansive economic prosperity, and an active national building program. And so because you had all these people being born, in the late mid to late 40s and early 50s, they had to go to school somewhere, and there weren't enough schools for them. And so this marks a historical trend that we see across the nation, really, after World War II, of this flurry of school building efforts as a way to, to keep up with the baby boomers, so to speak, particularly in growing urban areas like Grand Forks. And so these six schools, they date to the late 40s through the early 60s is when they were built. And they also, if we're talking architecturally, they also demonstrate and kind of maintain a basis in the modern movement, and that was very characteristic of mid 20th century American public architecture. And so these are all one story brick structures. They all have flat roofs, which is, you think, kind of mundane, but it's actually kind of in a distinctive architectural style, and one that departed from the previous more common, 2 to 3 story schools of the early decades of the 20th century. And so the new style of architecture, what it did is it reflected both, evolving educational principles, ones that emphasize student learning and also physical health, and then an efficiency of design and construction. And another thing that unites all of these buildings is they have very sprawling, low, elevation designs, as I mentioned. They have long banks of windows, and that's so that it can bring in a lot of, maximum or a lot of natural light. You can maximize that natural light. And they often overlooked gardens that were carefully landscaped, or playgrounds, or nearby parks. And so the idea was to kind of, make nature accessible, even from the inside of the building, and just by being able to gaze out onto it.
Well, I went to one of these schools. I am a baby boomer, and my elementary school was actually built before World War I, and that was a very traditional kind of structure back then, which had coat rooms, that kind of thing. And now, of course, everything has lockers for individual students. But the school I went to in South Moorhead was called South Junior High. There was a carbon copy of it on the north side of town called North Junior High. They have perhaps different functions now, but they were one story, flat roof, lots of windows, and they were set up for an educational process that was, of course, the way it was done when I was going to junior high. And that is a teacher in the front of the room and 30 desks somewhere else in the room.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, one of the things you pointed to is just the ubiquitous nature of these types of designs. I mean, if you go to other places in the Great Plains or in the Midwest or other places in the United States, you'll see very similar kids going to attend school in very similar looking buildings. It was the style of the time. It was that kind of post-war modern style, and as we know with architecture, like fashion or anything else, they move in trends. And so that was definitely the trend of the mid 20th century. That was what was hot in terms of school architecture at the time.
So, what was the process? This is Zachary J. Lechner. He's an historic preservation specialist with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Zach, what was the process for designating these Grand Forks schools? Did you talk to the school board? Was there a groundswell? How did this happen?
Yeah, we got the nomination, and there was definitely some community definitely community support. I mean, there were also, as there are sometimes with potential nominations, some concern about what this might mean in terms of what we can do with the structure. And I'll be happy to discuss some of the kind of details in general of that kind of discussion later. But yeah, I mean, what typically, like with this one, and what typically happens with other nominations is we will get an inquiry from the public, and someone who says, I own this building, I own this site, I'm interested in potentially putting it on or in the National Register, getting it in the register. What do I do? And we our office at the Historical Society, the State Historical Society of North Dakota, we walk that person through the process. So we are kind of a liaison, I guess you could say, between the person writing the nomination, proposing the structure or the site of the building, and then the National Park Service, which actually makes the determination of whether something will be placed in the register. And so in this case, the nomination was written, we reviewed it, we provided feedback on it. The person worked in those revisions. And then, as it happens every time with a nominated site, it went before our State Historic Preservation Review Board, which is a collection of several experts in the field of archaeology, history, architecture. They reviewed the nomination. They approved the nomination, and then the person writing the nomination worked in some of those revisions, those requested revisions. We sent it on to the National Park Service. They had some comments. The person writing the nomination worked through those comments, included the revised version and a new draft to us, and we resubmitted that on their behalf. And lo and behold, it was approved. But it can be, as you can tell from my description of it, it is a bureaucratic process. I mean, we're dealing with state and government entities, so it can take a while. But our office, our State Historic Preservation Office within the Historical Society, our job really is to help people who are interested in writing nominations to kind of navigate that process, which is often unfamiliar to them. And so the person writing the nomination can either just be, John or Jane Q. Public, just someone with an interest in preservation, or and sometimes it's a professional, a member of an architectural firm or a preservation group that someone may have hired to write research and write the nomination. So those are typically the main ways that we get nominations into our office, and what we do with them essentially.
Will these buildings have some plaques affixed to them, or will be there some indication to the public about their significance?
They can plaques are not automatically bestowed, but the but a plaque can be purchased and can be affixed, yes, to the site. But yeah, it is not automatically given out by the National Park Service, but it is written into the register, into the National Register of Historic Places, so that that information can be found online, and so yeah, it is unless it is changed substantially, changed enough so that it might no longer maintain the historic integrity or architectural integrity that would have put it into the register in the first place. It will remain, in among those that on that hallowed list. So, it's quite a prestigious designation.
Are any of these schools, the six that we've mentioned in Grand Forks, vacant or used for something else now?
That's a good question. I'm not 100% sure on that. I wish I had a better answer to your question, but I don't know if off the top of my head of what if any of them are currently vacant.
Can they be demolished? Can they be used for some other purpose?
In this case of the schools, they could be demolished. I mean, certainly, the National Park Service and the our state Historic Preservation Office. I mean, we're always interested in trying to ensure that things are preserved. But if if the owners of the school, in this case, I'm assuming the district, if they made that determination that they would need or that they wanted to alter or even go as far as to demolish the schools, what they would do is because they do receive the schools do receive federal funding, they'd just be required to submit their plan for comment to three different entities. So one would be the Grand Forks Historic Preservation Commission, another would be the State Historic Preservation Office with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. And then the third is to a federal entity, and that is the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. But typically, in these types of situations, it would really ultimately be up to the owner's decision whether or not to go ahead with the alteration or the demolition.
The modern movement in architecture and design is literally everywhere around where we live, at any rate. In Bismarck, Fargo, Grand Forks is filled with buildings that came from this period. As a matter of fact, when I was going to that junior high in South Moorhead, my classmates were children of the architect, and they lived in the house that was designed that looked a lot like the school 2 blocks north of that school. And right now, the director of radio for Prairie Public lives in that house. Bill Thomas lives in that house from the modern movement. So these are so prevalent. Again, what is it about them that makes them special?
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly, they kind of tick all the boxes. When we talk about kind of mid 20th century modern school architecture, they kind of tick all the boxes in terms of some of those features that I mentioned. Just from the one story, the brick structure, the type of the flat roof, among other things. And then they're just they're fairly well preserved, and they are still used at this point. And so we talk a lot in the National Register program about historic integrity. Does this site, does this building, does it maintain its historic integrity? And that's the historic integrity is composed of a whole bunch of a bunch of different things. But these buildings, they haven't been moved. They're still in the lands, the place in which they were built. They're still kind of surrounded by those gardens or playgrounds or typically those public parks. So it's like if you were to go there, it would more or less feel how like the way it was when it was constructed. They haven't been. Sure, there's going to be alterations to a school built in 1949 to make it, to make it work in 2020. But much of the interior and certainly the exterior is remarkably well preserved. So I think kind of maintaining that historic integrity, that's a really critical thing, and certainly something that these six schools have been able to do.
Zachary J. Lechner is a historic preservation specialist with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Zachary, you've been here a relatively short amount of time since January. What can you tell us about how the State Historical Society prioritizes preservation projects?
Well, it's it depends. It's based on a whole host of things. I mean, we do a lot of things in the State Historic Preservation Office, which again is located within the State Historical Society of North Dakota. A lot of it has to do with funding, some of which certainly we get state funding, and some funding, say, to distribute grants we get through the federal government. So some of it has to do with funding. Some of it has to do with certain mandates, things that we're required to do by enabling legislation from the federal government. So I'll give you a good example of this. One thing that we're currently working on now is our new state historic preservation plan, and we are required, every 5 years or so by the federal government to rework, to revise our historic preservation plan. And this is just essentially a fairly lengthy document explaining not just to the government but to the public, what we're planning to do and where our efforts are going to be focused for the next 5 years in terms of historic preservation. And so what we're currently doing is we're trying to get feedback from the public on a survey that we then can use to inform our revisions to that state historic preservation plan. And so the survey is designed to gauge public awareness of certain programs like the National Register of Historic Places or the National Historic Landmarks Program, federal and state preservation laws, and really other kind of preservation related requirements and activities. So just we want to know, like, yeah, what's the public, gauge the public awareness of these types of things. And then the survey will also give the public a chance to offer input on different types of activities that they would like to see the Historical Society focus on. So that might be preservation of archaeological sites, holding preservation workshops, surveying and documenting historical resources. And then we want to get a sense too from the public, their ideas about what challenges they see facing historic preservation efforts in the state of North Dakota, be that urban development or, the limits on state funding or just competition for volunteer time. And so this, partly the survey is very helpful in helping us to then figure out exactly where we should be, kind of putting, our time and how we should be distributing funds and figuring out where we should be, placing most of our efforts over the course of the next 5 years.
Before you came here, you were teaching in college and you were an author writing, I think, about sort of the southern vibe of our country, I guess. What brought you to North Dakota?
Well, this position did actually, and I was somebody who has been in academia and then someone who kind of dabbled in public history. And so one of the things I like about this position is that it allows me to utilize my historian and historical training, but to apply it in a way that makes it accessible to the public. And so sometimes when you're at academia, you know that stereotype of the ivory tower, I think, has been diminished over the years. But certainly, I feel like in this position, I'm able to really kind of bring history and the importance of historic preservation before the public in a way that I had not previously been able to do. So that's been very, very, very useful and engaging for me.
Zachary J. Lechner is Historic Preservation Specialist with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. You can find out more information about preservation, about other issues with history of our state at history.nd.gov. Zachary, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Coming up on Main Street, a Conversations on Healthcare podcast about kids going back to school in a time of pandemic, and a Harvest Public Media report about school meals. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Both Senators John Hoeven and Kevin Cramer support the appointment of a Supreme Court justice to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg prior to the election. Cramer, appearing on MSNBC, said the seat should be filled without delay.
I don't hold the Cramer seat, I don't hold the Heitkamp seat, I don't hold the Conrad seat or the Burdick seat. I hold North Dakota's first seat in the Senate. She was an associate justice. It's not her seat, it wasn't before, and it won't be again. With all due respect to her incredible legacy there, it's really not about the predecessor. It's about the people of this country.
Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney says he supports voting to fill Bader Ginsburg's seat. That all but ensures President Trump has the backing needed to push the nomination over Democratic objections so close to the November election. Romney had been a key holdout. Trump expects to announce his pick by week's end. North Dakota Highway Patrol says there's been an increase in the number of all-terrain vehicle fatals. The patrol sergeant, Wade Cattermas, says so far in 2020, there have been six fatal ATV crashes.
In 2019, compared to the same time frame, we were at three. And And actually, in 2018, we only had two fatality crashes involving ATV or recreational vehicles.
Kattermas says the patrol is taking a special interest in these ATV crashes.
You know, what we want to remind operators of these type of vehicles is to utilize all the safety equipment that they can, whether it's helmets or I know a lot of these off-highway vehicles have seatbelts. Those seatbelts are there for a reason. They're used to keep you inside the vehicle if the vehicle rolls over.
Kattermas says the North Dakota Parks and Rec Department has been offering safety courses for younger drivers to take so they can operate the vehicles safely.
They do need to have either the safety course certification or a valid operator's license.
And North Dakota's tax commissioner says it isn't a surprise. Ryan Rauschenberger says taxable sales and purchases for April, May, and June were down 22.5% compared to the same three-month period in 2019. Taxable sales and purchases totaled $4.34 billion. Rauschenberger says there were two major factors that caused the downward trend. One was COVID-19.
You know, we had shutdown of businesses. People weren't moving around the economy as much. We didn't have as much activity in the oil patch. When we had, frankly, significant declines, it was really the beginning of significant declines in the oil patch. You know, oil makes up as much of a third of our sales tax base.
Rauschenberger says wholesale trade was also down by about 31%. He says one bright spot came in collections of sales tax from online retailers.
Interestingly, you know, wholesale trade was up in second quarter. Well, a lot of that was because there were massive shipments of online sales.
Rauschenberger says he is expecting some recovery in the third quarter, July, August, and September, but it won't be back to 2019 levels. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Today, we'll share another excerpt from the Conversations on Healthcare podcast. Dr. Sarah Goza is president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and in this podcast excerpt, she discusses how pediatricians can help inform the tough decisions families are making to keep kids safe and send them back to school. She discussed the issues with podcast hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter.
Dr. Goza, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me today.
Like so many things associated with the pandemic, our knowledge of COVID-19 seems to grow with time. And a first data point suggested that children weren't as affected as older adults, but now we know children are very efficient carriers, spreaders of the virus, and it can also have devastating health impact on them. What advice is the American Academy of Pediatrics offering to its own member clinicians, but also to families across the country on what may be the best and safest way to navigate the school year?
You know, I think every family is different. And so my message to every family is call your pediatrician, call your family practice doctor, call someone who knows you, your family, and your child to discuss what's going to be in the best interest of your family, especially if you have children with special health care needs, or you have parents in your home or grandparents who may be living there, who may be at higher risk for COVID-19. We know that public health measures work too. We know that we have to get the rate of community spread down, and we can do that. We can have everyone wear a mask, physical distancing, hand washing, and avoiding large gatherings, and really staying home if you can. I mean, really not going out and doing a lot of the things that we normally would do to try to get that rate of spread down. Because if we can get that rate of spread down in communities, our children can go back to school. They can go back to their sports. They will be able to do the things that they're used to doing. But if we don't get that number down, then children will continue to get this virus.
This summer, we certainly saw a spike among children and young adults. We saw some at schools, at summer camps, and now college campuses. I know some opened, then closed. What are your data revealing about childhood infection rates and the risk to children and teens and young adults as well as their families as they spread the virus, which they seem quite capable of doing?
You know, the rising number of cases in children really corresponds with the overall rise of COVID-19. But we did see a big spike in the summer, and I think that's because children were getting back out and getting around other people again. But also, the parents were getting the disease. They were getting COVID-19 because they were back at work and getting it. And so they were spreading it as well to their children. We know there's been substantial spread and that children are going to get it. The one thing we do know is that children are not immune to this disease. Children can get COVID. They can get very sick with COVID. And they can be hospitalized with COVID. We know that that is less than with the adult population, but it's still there. And we have seen those numbers. We think more widespread testing also was partly to account for those increases in numbers, but we also saw rises in hospitalizations and deaths. So we know that it was truly a true increase in the numbers of children becoming infected. And what we have to do is we have to still, just like we said, wear your mask, wash your hands, physical distance, and really, really try to get those numbers down.
Okay. Dr. Goza, the American Academy of Pediatrics had recommended a couple of months ago that kids be sent back to school, citing the potential of long-term impact on mental health, educational track, and social development. And you recommended educators should do their best to ensure that children can come back, but they also needed to keep kids safe with masks, social distancing, and other measures that you just walked us through. Has there been any shift in its position on this?
We still believe that the goal should be for children to be in school in person. And you know the reasons, the mental health, the social, emotional, developmental issues. You know, our children are losing. We have an education gap already. And the children having to do online schooling, there is a internet gap, you know, where some people have internet and computers and others don't. So that's going to increase that education gap. We have children losing social skills, the autism children. Some of my patients in my practice, the parents call me and say they're losing their ground. And so the goal is still to get children back into in-person school. We have not changed our guidance on that. But we know that you have to look at what's happening in your local communities, where what your spread is. If the spread is high, you're surging with numbers of COVID-19, it is probably not very safe to open your schools. And public health has to be involved in that decision-making process along with the school systems. We also have some school systems who are not able to do the mitigation that we recommend. You know, they're just not able to do that. There needs to be funding for that from the federal government. We have to have funding. We have to have public health and the school systems working together and the communities working together to get the community spread down, to do the mitigation that they need to do in the schools, because it is so critical for our children. We have food insecurity as well. Those children who don't have access to food, who are hungry. You can't learn when you're hungry. And so we know that it's critical to get those goals in sight and to really work towards making that so that children can get back into school. But we have to make sure it's safe, not only for the children, but for the faculty and staff.
You know, Dr. Goza, it wasn't just the schools that were closed. Practices were closed across the country. When we look back at the early weeks in March and April and May, and with it, just a vast reduction in well-child routine health maintenance checkups for children, along with that, the decrease in vaccinations. And I think people have been so creative and so disciplined about bringing up telehealth, coming up with clinics to just do the vaccinations and catch people up. But now we head into flu season. How is the American of Pediatrics addressing this consequence of the pandemic? And what are your recommendations to your pediatric community in the field about how to make this catch up happen?
I've been very proud of the American Academy of Pediatrics in this time. We have moved very nimbly and very quickly to put out guidance. Our first guidance was to clinics, to practices, to say, you know, prioritize the young children, make sure we're getting those vaccines in. If that's all you can do, do that. Try to rearrange your office so you can have an area where it's only well visits, an area that's only sick visits or different times of the day. Moving into telehealth, we had webinars about how to do telehealth, how to get paid for it. We advocated for payment for telehealth through Medicaid and through the other payers. We started a campaign called hashtag call your pediatrician on social media to try to get parents to realize that pediatricians were still open. And then we just recently came out with a guidance on caring for ill children in your practice. And it talks about some of the things you can do to try to make your practice safe. You know, not having a waiting room, bringing people in one at a time, seeing children outside if you think they're truly contagious, doing testing outside in the parking lot or somewhere, and still trying to keep those children up to date on their vaccines, get those checkups in and get them in, you know, getting a list of your patients that are not up to date and calling them and getting them to make appointments, continuing to do telehealth, as we've talked about. We also put out guidance on testing with that about what children should be tested. And it talks about the different tests that are out there, when they should be used, what they're good for, what they're not good for. And also, you know, which children you really, you know, children that are sick, that have been exposed should definitely be tested. Children that you're not sure what's going on probably should be tested that are symptomatic. And then when to test asymptomatic children that if they've had an exposure, so you can do contact tracing.
Great. We're speaking today with Dr. Sally Goza, president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, an organization of 67,000 members. Dr. Goza, I want to pull the thread on the conversation you were just having with Margaret around telehealth. You obviously can't give a flu shot over the phone, but it's a hand-in-glove relationship between telemedicine and in-person visits. As you look forward, how's the association dealing with CMS on the regulatory side? What are you looking for from the government in terms of guidance? Because I would imagine for a lot of practices, if this is going to be a long-term permission, there are additional investments that are going to need to make. Tell us about advocacy that you're doing on behalf of telehealth, and what are the other issues that you're focused in on?
You know, we came out with guidance on telehealth very quickly. We had webinars for our practices, for practices and pediatricians to watch. We will continue. We know telehealth is here to stay, and we've been very excited about some of the uses it's had. Our subspecialist and our surgical specialist were really quick to pick up on using telehealth. Absolutely. I mean, they had webinars in their own sections about how to use telehealth. And this has really been helpful for especially our rural communities where children have to travel 2 and 3 hours to get to mm-hmm. subspecialists mm-hmm. to be able to see their subspecialist on a telehealth visit. I had a patient yesterday who would have waited months to get a genetics appointment and because of telehealth was able to get it right away. And so I think that there are a lot of good reasons to have telehealth. We're going to be advocating to continue the parity in payment, to continue some of the regulations that have been relaxed about whether it can be the origin of it and those kind of things, where you can do telehealth from. All of those things we're going to continue to advocate for. And also talking about, you know, what does it mean about cross state lines? If you have a patient who's in college in another state and you see them for something, you know, will it be still okay to see that patient even across state lines without having licensure issues? So I think we will continue to look at this as we go forward as to whether the best practices. We have a section on telehealth who is looking at this very seriously and coming up with recommendations that I haven't seen yet, but that are coming up about how do we move forward as the pandemic goes away, what do we want telehealth to look like going into the future?
Well, Dr. Goza, I wonder if I could talk about something other than COVID, which is hard to find these days. We're all very concerned with workforce issues and workforce in primary care. And we know we have a distribution problem, and we actually have a pipeline problem as well. And primary care struggles as people are pulled to some of the specialties. I wonder from your vantage point at the American Academy of Pediatrics, if you would speak a little bit to how you are inspiring the next generation of medical students or just children coming up in the pipeline to think about pediatric primary care.
So I'd just like to say first, in my own practice, when I have children tell me they're interested in medicine, I'm always talking to them about pediatrics when they're there. I'm like, pediatrics is the best thing. Well, I'll come back and work with you, doctor, because I'm like, fine. You just get through here and go do it. I also try to encourage patients when they're talking about going into medicine, not to get discouraged in those first years in college. And that, you know, sometimes you stumble when you first go to college. There are other things that entice you to do, mm-hmm. you know, and to continue to be committed to it and to realize that they can make it. The AAP is very interested in the pipeline. We are starting to look at ways that we can address pre-college even, you mm-hmm. know, if there's ways to do that. But also we now have a medical student section on trainees, and the medical students can join that. One of our fastest growing sections is because of the medical students have been joining in, and they can come to our meetings. They can be involved in activities at the academy. And I think, you know, once they see what the academy does and mm-hmm. what pediatricians do, that mm-hmm. pediatricians aren't, especially primary care pediatricians, aren't just in an office seeing patients, that we work outside the office, that our goal is to work on everything that affects children. So mm-hmm. we know what happens to children is very little of what happens in the exam rooms. It's really what's happening to them outside in the world. Yeah. And so addressing those social determinants of health, those public health issues and things like that. And so encouraging people to understand that going into pediatrics means that you're really looking at the future of this world, because we're taking care of our future and trying to make sure that they're healthy and that they grow up to lead the best lives they can. And so I think that's part of it, is that motivation that this is really more than just being a pediatrician in the exam room taking care of sore throats and earaches. It's really taking care of the whole child. We also look at team-based care. We have a team-based care policy. We believe that that's the best way to do it. Everyone should work up to the top of their license and what they're trained to do, because that's how we're going to be able to spread out and do the work that needs to be done. Absolutely. You look at mental health now. I mean, we need, you know, that takes up so much time in a primary care office, and we need to be able to do that. It's so critical to do it. And so we all need to be working to the top of our licenses. Also, nurse practitioners and PAs can also be members of the National Academy as well. We have a area for them too.
Well, I like so much your thought that healthcare is not only what's inside the four walls, but it's outside. And I know the AAP has really a robust policy agenda, really thinking about these social determinants of health, which in many ways, I think this younger generation is very focused in on as well, animated about it. You talked earlier about food insecurity. Maybe walk through the work in policy and advocacy around social determinants, whether it's gun violence or substance use disorder, or as we've discussed earlier, the impact that poverty has on adverse childhood events, on health outcomes. What's driving your policy initiatives right now? And how does the public get engaged with the work that you're doing and better understand the work that you're doing?
You know, right now, our major focus is actually on health equity and the disparities that exist in this world. You know, and that includes all of those things. That includes poverty, food insecurity, racism, gun violence. You name the disparity that's out there, and we know that that a lot of it is based on racism and poverty. I mean, our Black children and our American Indian, Alaskan Natives, and our Hispanic children are much more disproportionately affected by all of these things. And so it is a broad umbrella to look at all of that. And I think racism has kind of risen to the top this year, is one of the things that, because we know that Black and Hispanic children are more likely to get COVID and more likely to be sick with it. We know that they are the number one group of children that are being admitted to the hospital with the multi-inflammatory system disorder. And so we are really trying to look at how can we affect change in the health equity and the disparities. And we know that we have to address racism as one of the top things. Poverty's still there. We've been trying to address poverty for years, and we're going to continue to address the issues with poverty. We're still working on gun violence. We're still working on substance use disorder. All of those things are still being worked. Mental health is another one. So it's really a village. I mean, you know, one thing is not disconnected from the other. And so it's all just this big thing of how do we make sure and decrease those disparities and have health equity and have children have the equal chances in this world. We know right now they do not.
Dr. Goza, we want to thank you for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, thank you for all you do, and thank you for having me today.
Dr. Sarah Goza, president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, in a discussion with Conversations on Healthcare hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. You can follow healthcare issues at chcradio.com. Next on Main Street, school lunch in a pandemic.
Prairie Public is here to help you in the 2020-21 school year. PBS Learning Media has thousands of curated, standards-aligned videos, interactives, lesson plans, and more, easily searchable by grade level and discipline. And it's all free. Find it at prairiepublic.org/education.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas, Director of Radio at Prairie Public. I want to take a moment to say thank you to all the people who have contributed during our fall membership drive here at Prairie Public. And without you, we could not do it. We had donations from across the region of all different levels, and we're sending out Prairie Public face masks to everybody who donated, and some people won some great prizes. We had a lot of fun, and we're so happy to hear from you during this unusual time with so much news going on. We actually reduced the total amount of time that we spent talking about the drive because there was so much news going on, but you came through anyway, and we appreciate it. If you haven't had a chance to donate and want to, you can still participate in the fall drive for a couple more days by calling 800-359-4145 or going to prairiepublic.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. During the summer, schools and other community sites that offer children free meals experienced soaring demand. Now that school's in session, meals remain free for all kids, because the federal government has extended pandemic support for now. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports.
School meals contribute significantly to alleviating childhood hunger. But normally, a family has to apply for their children to get a free or reduced price meal. The U.S. Department of Agriculture relaxed rules in March, including making meals free for all children. It recently announced those pandemic provisions will stay in place. Kim Bellstein is the food service director for the Belmont Clemmie Community School District in North Iowa. She says on a call with others about the extension, one caveat loomed large.
They'll be free until December 31st or until funds run out. So what if you continue to feed and then find out that, oh, they ran out of money in October and you fed through November?
Districts and families could be caught with a debt they weren't expecting to owe. Belmont Clemmie is in a county where recently more than 50% of students qualified for free or reduced price meals. Bellstein says the district is committed to feeding every child, regardless of ability to pay. Not all districts can afford that. Lunchtime at the elementary school looks different this fall. Everyone's wearing a mask or face shield. Children enter the lunchroom but don't stay long.
They walk down and grab their milk and then come through the line, and we have everything in a bag at that point for them.
Pizza dippers. Pizza dippers. They're called pizza crust.
The hot entree is wrapped in foil and added to a paper bag that today has cantaloupe slices, baby carrots, chips, and a granola bar. There's no salad bar or any self-serve. Other than type of milk, the kids have no choices. And they take their milk and sack lunch back to the classroom to eat. Ongoing free meals is a victory for the School Nutrition Association, which lobbied hard for the extension.
In this economy, we've seen a dramatic increase in food insecure families. We know millions more kids will depend on school meals this year.
Spokesperson Diane Pratt-Hebner says whether in the building or at home, kids can't learn when they're hungry.
And this year we're asking so much more of our students. They have to figure out distance learning or modified school day schedules. We should not allow them to worry about whether they'll get a healthy meal.
And so many families need help. In June, Illinois served almost 11 million meals, more than seven times the 2019 figure. Iowa served more than four times as many meals. Lunchtime Solutions is a private food service company that contracts with schools in several Midwest states. Even as they provided meals during the summer, Heather Wall says the company prepared a base menu for fall with extreme flexibility.
It could be adapted very easily depending on what the district's mitigation efforts were. And change almost instantaneously.
Meals have to work in the lunchroom, the classroom, or the to-go bag.
Menus are designed to have one home style, one hot kind of convenience type of food that is really kid friendly, like chicken nuggets or cheeseburgers, that kind of thing. And then one deli sandwich.
Or some other cold option. Plus, always milk, fruit, and vegetables. At Belmont Clemmie Junior Senior High, Kim Bellstein sends out a few meals each day for students learning online. The rest are delivered to students in their classrooms to avoid congestion in the halls and cafeteria. She says if a COVID-19 exposure quarantines kids at home, as has already happened to the football team, her staff will provide pickup meals for families that want them. Despite the changes and challenges, she says her mission remains crystal clear.
It's just what we do. No matter how you get them fed, you just feed them.
She's confident no one is going hungry. Oh, and she says the kids are actually happier with fresh raw vegetables than a cup of steamed peas. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaborative that covers farm and food policy issues. You can follow the reporting at harvestpublicmedia.org. Decoded 8 Book is next.
Prairie Public is proud to be the media sponsor of the FM Visual Artist Studio Crawl, October 3rd and 4th, noon to 6 p.m. See Fargo-Moorhead artists at work. Ask questions and perhaps be inspired to create your own art. Find a map to begin your tour at prairiepublic.org.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datebook for September 22nd. It's not often that a man's life achievements are overshadowed by his champion butterfat-producing cow, but that is exactly what happened to Samuel F. Crabb. Born in 1869, he graduated from the University of Wisconsin and came to Fargo in 1891, was a civil engineer for the city for 16 years. Crabb was responsible for paving Broadway the first time. He used wooden blocks. He then served as a consulting engineer for the Cass County Drainage Board for 18 years. He was instrumental in building Cass County's network of drainage ditches. Crabb was also a passionate dairy farmer. He imported 7 cows and bulls from the island of Jersey. His Jersey herd became one of the best in the country. He was also involved with the dairy program at North Dakota Agricultural College. He helped secure appropriations from the state for a dairy building in 1913 and then drew up the plans for the dairy building and the dairy barns on campus. Crabb later served as the president of the American Jersey Cattle Club from 1928 to 1931. On this date in 1914, Crabb's champion cow, Noble's Golden Marguerite, was born. She was the daughter of Noble Duke of Oaklands. Her mother was Goldie's Marguerite. In 1921, Noble's Golden Marguerite produced 977.69 pounds of butterfat. This record for the most butterfat from a North Dakota cow was not broken until 1969. When Noble's Golden Marguerite died in 1932 at the age of 18, the president of the North Dakota Agricultural College, John Shepherd, and the chairman of the Department of Dairy Husbandry, Professor J.R. Dice, decided that this most noble cow should be buried in front of the dairy building. Thus, Noble's Golden Marguerite found her final resting place in front of the building her owner had designed. A plaque on a large stone was placed over her grave so that everyone who walked by would be aware of her great achievement. Much has changed since Noble's Golden Marguerite died. The dairy building is now the Geosciences Building, and the concrete cow head that was mounted above the front entrance was removed. Noble's Golden Marguerite's commemorative stone is now in front of Shepherd Arena. Students often hear about the dead cow on campus during campus tours, but few know the name Crabb or are aware of his ditches or wood-cobbled roadway. However, Crabb is not too far away from his champion cow. He died in 1949 and is buried 4 miles away at Riverside Cemetery. Today's Dakota Datebook written by Trista Razor Sturza. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As you know, when we broadcast, we also stream at prairiepublic.org. And you can find any Main Street show after the broadcast at prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on our show, the UND Writers Conference put the event online this year. It's being done by spreading it out over several weeks on Thursday evenings. And we'll talk about it with Conference Director Crystal Alberts on our show on Wednesday. We'll find out how the first night went and preview the coming weeks. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.